Recorded Thursday, February the 9th at the St. Petersburg Museum of History. Here is Executive Director Rui Frias at Happy Hour with the Historian.
Thank you so much for joining us tonight for Happy Hour with the Historian. We're proud to be here for our 10th season. So we appreciate all the support and, you know, filling the room every month, and actually multiple times a month, that you're going to hear in a few minutes. I wanted to talk a little bit about our exhibits. We have lots of changes coming in February. If you happened at the bar to peek into the main gallery, it's pretty much empty except for brand new painted walls, because we have a new exhibit coming in there fairly shortly. But before that even opens, we're making some changes to the baseball gallery. We're adding an exhibit called Black Baseball in Living Color. It's an exhibit of... It's an exhibit of 72 portraits of players in the Negro Leagues from the late 1800s to the 1950s. Tomorrow, you'll get an invite to a special edition Happy Hour with a Historian on February 22nd, featuring the author of the book on the Negro Leagues. And when I say the book, I mean the book on the Negro Leagues. It has every single player that played on those teams in those leagues listed in there. So he's going to talk, he actually commissioned the artist to paint the portraits that will be hanging in the gallery starting on Monday. Nevin, our curator, has been working on it the last 2 days to get everything up and ready. But what we're really excited about is an exhibit called Civil Rights in the Sunshine State that will fill our main gallery with photos, panels, artifacts depicting the long struggle here in Florida, the Civil Rights Movement. Part of the gallery will feature specific events related to St. Petersburg. And as you enter the gallery, you'll be walking through St. Petersburg's own African-American Heritage Trail, thanks to Gwendolyn Reese, who's with us tonight.
Awesome.
If you're a museum member, you'll be getting an invite in the next couple days for a sneak preview on February 24th. If you're not yet a member, this is a perfect reason to join tonight before you leave, right? So you can attend it as well. So we got some special thanks here to the City of St. Petersburg for giving us this wonderful, or renting us this wonderful space on the waterfront. Pilot Bank, the Boehner Charitable Trust, the Willis Family, the Tampa Bay Times, Hennessy Construction, Florida Humanities. And I would like to introduce someone very special to us, our new presenting sponsor of Happy Hour with the Historian, Southern Roots Realty. Please welcome Natalie DeVicente.
Good evening. My name is Natalie DeVicente, and I'm the broker and owner of Southern Roots Realty. We are so excited to be the presenting sponsor of this year's Happy Hour with the Historian series. I am a third-generation native of St. Petersburg, and my husband is a fifth-generation native of St. Petersburg. So the history and stories of St. Pete and Florida have been very important to our family. I have proudly served on the St. Petersburg Museum of History's board for 7 years and have continued to work on various committees and projects in the last few years. The museum is an important community partner to help us educate visitors and residents in our city. Happy Hour with the Historian is just one of the ways in which the museum shares our past and how it shapes our present and our future. We're excited to hear Dr. Mike Butler share how Dr. Martin Luther King saw St. Augustine as an opportunity to bring change in the civil rights movement. And we thank you for the opportunity to share these stories.
Thank you, Natalie. Thank you for your support. Tonight's speaker is a distinguished professor of history at Flagler College, where he's taught since 2008. His work has appeared in many leading academic publications, such as the Journal of American Studies, the Journal of Southern History, the Florida Historical Quarterly, and Southern Cultures. His book, Beyond Integration, the Black Freedom Struggle in Escambia County, Florida, from 1960 to 1980, won a 2017 Florida Book Award in nonfiction. He specializes in Southern cultural history with an emphasis on the Black freedom struggle, teaches a number of classes on the topic, and has spoken to dozens of community groups about the civil rights movement here in Florida. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. J. Michael Butler.
Thank you for coming. Thank you to the museum for the invitation. I always enjoy having the opportunity to speak about topics that are so central in our understanding who we are, at least while it's still legal. think that one of the things to keep in mind about the civil rights movement in Florida is that, number one, yeah, there was a movement in Florida. Oftentimes, students of mine, people who are not third and fifth generation Floridians, wonder, wait a minute, Florida? I thought it was the Sunshine State. I thought it was open for business. I didn't think it was part of the Deep South. From the chuckles, I gather that I'm speaking to mostly Floridians. One of the things that Ruby said was that my specialty, one of my areas of expertise, is Southern cultural history. And culturally speaking, Florida is about as South as you can get. Right? And there's so much that we can learn about the national civil rights movement, the national struggle, by putting Florida at the center of the movement, not the periphery. One of my favorite documentarians, Billy Corbin, says that the Florida of today is the America of tomorrow. And nowhere is that more clear than when we examine our collective civil rights past. So, there are going to be several themes that surface, and I'll point them out as we go. But I like to approach these programs like it's story time with Dr. Butler, because it is a story, and it's an important story, right? And I'm going to tell the story of how Dr. King became interested in the St. Augustine movement and all of the complexities that came with that. So, you know, with no further ado, when someone asks about Florida's violent, dare I say, uncomfortable history, remind them that between 1890 and 1930, Florida led the nation in per capita lynchings. Yes. It was more dangerous for an African American to live in Florida than Mississippi at the same time. We had clearances as they were called. We had politically motivated racial violence. We had the first NAACP officer assassinated in his home with his wife. Florida is not periphery to our nation's long racial past. It is indeed central. So that may be another topic for another day, and maybe I can come back and share with you some of the things that I've learned in teaching the state civil rights history. With St. Augustine, it's really interesting because it's an interesting city in that, number one, I've been there long enough now to be able to say that St. Augustine has a little bit of an inferiority complex. A little bit. Right? They say, and I've heard this several times, it's a great line, that when the Pilgrims were having Thanksgiving in Plymouth, we were undergoing urban renovation in St. Augustine. Right? That somehow the nation's history books have left St. Augustine out of the colonial past because we were Spanish. There's some truth to that. And that's important to keep in mind as I introduce what Dr. King called the magnificent drama. You see, St. Augustine is a southern town. It was, it is, and it probably will be for quite some time, at least in cultural mores. We have a segregated part of the city that thrived during, it, well, number one, it grew up during the Reconstruction era. It's now called Lincolnville. At the time, it was called Little Africa. It was land that white people in St. Augustine thought uninhabitable. So that's where freedmen went. They build this thriving community. It becomes the model of the Booker T. Washington School of raising ourselves up by our bootstraps and creating a vibrant culture and economy within a segregated society, right? Now, part of the Jim Crow era depended in the South on one word, and that word was paternalism. Race relations were always good if you, as African Americans, knew your so-called place. You obey by the racial mores of the time. You stay in Lincolnville. You do as you're told. You don't start a fuss. You don't protest. And we'll take care of you as white people. We will hire you in good jobs in the community. Dr. Robert Hayling knew that. He learned it really fast. Dr. Robert Hayling was a dentist. His father was a professor at Florida A&M. He was a Tallahassee native, an Air Force veteran who moved to St. Augustine in the early 1960s. He thought initially that St. Augustine was a unique place because in his black-owned dental practice, he had both white and black customers. Of course, they were segregated in the waiting room, and of course, he lived in a segregated part of town, but there was a degree of familiarity, paternalism, that he appreciated at least until he got out of that so-called place. Now, one of the things that I want everyone to understand is that the civil rights struggle, the struggle for black equality in this country, does not start with one person nor end with his assassination. As long as African Americans have been brought to this country, there's a theme that connects their history and its resistance. A struggle to assert their humanity in places and times where they were seen as less than human. That's enslavement, that's all the way through today. Arguably, that's what protests are about. You see it even in Memphis now, the familiar refrain, I am a man, recognize my humanity, resisting dehumanization. So, Dr. Hayling is not the beginning, Dr. King is not the beginning of the movement. There is a long period of unacceptance and resistance to the status quo. And one of the people who was the embodiment of this was a young man named Hank Thomas. Hank Thomas, in the 1960s, as the sit-in movement spread throughout the South, starts in Greensboro, North Carolina, for all intents and purposes, on February 1st, 1960. Hank Thomas decides that we are going to do sit-ins in St. Augustine, just like they're doing around the South. He had a group of friends, went to the downtown Woolworths. He was the only person that showed up. The police were called. Paternalism. Henry Thomas, we know your mama. She's going to be so upset she knew you were down here causing this mess. He wanted to be arrested. They refused to arrest him. Right? He basically then, in the aftermath, spoke to civic groups, spoke to churches, and said, we are not going to be taken seriously until we have someone who can help lead us who is not from St. Augustine. One of the things that we're going to keep coming back to is that there's an interplay between the national and local. Sometimes national movements and trends influence local movements and trends. Sometimes local movements and trends occur in response to national events, right? So you've got the sit-ins that are occurring starting in North Carolina, spread like wildfire. It impacts St. Augustine. Dr. Hayling heard the story and said, you know what? I'm going to be the person to step up. He became the youth advisor to the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People chapter in St. Augustine. He liked working with the young people because he loved their enthusiasm, their energy. Dr. Hayling was a remarkable person. I've heard him speak numerous times. We've talked numerous times. And anytime he told the story, he said, I didn't have to ask for anything. I didn't need to be treated like a second-class citizen. I earned my rights by serving this country. Young people loved him because he had absolutely no background. White people in positions of power learned to despise him because he did not recognize his so-called place. The quadricentennial. Back to St. Augustine in context, the big picture, right? The quadricentennial was the 400th anniversary of St. Augustine's foundation. This was a big deal. This was, from my original comment where I said St. Augustine kind of has an inferiority complex, this was going to be the time in 1963, 64, and 65 where that would be rectified. In other words, St. Augustine planned a big party where we are going to make history books throughout the nation as the nation's oldest city. Back in the spring of 1963, Lyndon Johnson, the vice president at the time, came to St. Augustine to kick off the festivities. He had a $350,000 federal grant to help St. Augustine throw this party. Dr. Haling and the NAACP adult branch thought, wow, how does it look that the nation's oldest city takes money from the federal government, but include no African Americans in any planning, refuse to hire black people in city employment, and will not even consider forming a biracial committee, a city group, where African Americans could bring their concerns and grievances to the city commission? No, we're not even talking about that, is what the mayor at the time said. As a matter of fact, the mayor at the time told the NAACP that by having a biracial committee, it admits that there are racial differences that we choose not to acknowledge. Yeah, I know, right? The threat was, when Lyndon Johnson comes to town, we will protest. We will carry signs saying, we are citizens too. The city flipped. No, please don't. We will include you. We will invite you to the banquet where President, Vice President Johnson spoke. We will grant you an audience with federal and local policymakers if you just don't protest and bring attention to it. So, Haling and the NAACP basically said, okay, we'll take your word for it. Yes, when they showed up at the banquet where Vice President Johnson sat, they were sat in a balcony guarded by Secret Service guards. They were not allowed to exit. They did not get their audience with the Vice President or any of his people. And the next day when they had their meeting with city officials, it was the mayor's secretary and a tape recorder. And she basically told them, speak into the microphone, tell us what you have to say. As Dr. Haling said, we'd been hoodwinked. We'd been hoodwinked. So now, the protests, the demonstrations begin. Dr. Haling, for many reasons, became persona non grata. He was seen as the racial agitator. He was the outside troublemaker who's riling up the youth. Yes, he was helping direct and organize and educating them. A little learning could be a dangerous thing, I've heard. So, as they ask themselves, what can we do to guarantee human equality? Medgar Evers is assassinated in Mississippi. June 1963. Dr. Haling was misquoted. I've never seen this written anywhere, but, and I was shocked for the first time I heard it. The St. Augustine Record, our local newspaper at the time, they had a very conservative board of editors, and they were bound and determined to not cover, or to, when they covered, to paint in as negative of a light this situation. So, Dr. Haling was quoted as saying, we will shoot first and ask questions later. We are not going to be slaughtered like Medgar Evers. What he really said was, we will arm ourselves to protect against being shot down like Medgar Evers. So when I heard him say that, I asked him, wait a minute, you were quoted, and he stopped me. He's like, I know, I never said it. But it put him on the radar as violent, aggressive, angry, militant, and he's infecting our young people. That only brought unprecedented attention to him. Now, we don't know why. Scholars still don't understand why, but St. Augustine was actually being monitored by the FBI before these demonstrations downtown began. Now, when I say that there are demonstrations, they aren't just protests for protest's sake, right? They had objectives. What they wanted was, number one, access to downtown accommodations. Some African-American employment in city positions. The formation of a biracial committee. And for the city to issue a statement asking ministers of religious faith to endorse racial equality. Not too radical, right? That's it. And when the city said no start on any of those points, then it was time to demonstrate their economic power. And that's the purpose of a demonstration. Do not spend money where you are not treated with dignity. Take your dollar somewhere else. You even see it. This is one of the, I think this is the Labor Day, one of the Labor Day demonstrations, where you can see, that's the sheriff actually, L.O. Davis, that's looking at the signs. I am an American also. My father died defending this country. And the sign behind, the third sign says, wear old clothes with dignity. The idea is, if you want, and you know, in talking to movement activists, both in St. Augustine and elsewhere, there is a strategy behind everything, guys. It's something that I didn't understand as a student. But everything is done for a calculated reason. As Reverend H.K. Matthews from Escambia County told me, their philosophy in Pensacola was, if you want to stay segregated, we'll help you stay that way all the way to bankruptcy. Right? Because his point was, people see black and white and they segregate, but the only color that really matters to them is green. There is an economic component. Do you stand by your racism? Or do you want to profit by welcoming all? That's the point. So, we know that the FBI was monitoring activities in St. Augustine. We're still not clear why. There are some speculative reasons, but it's really interesting that in 63, the activities in St. Augustine are highlighted by what we would call today hate groups at the national, state, and local levels. You had the Ku Klux Klan. The largest group in the area was in Jacksonville. You had the National States Rights Party and a member of the white Christian church, Reverend Connie Lynch, who came down, as he said, to rescue the embattled people of St. Augustine. And he didn't mean the black people. Connie Lynch to the left, J.B. Stoner to the right. Just a story. Oh, and the Ancient City Gun Club. This is really interesting as well because it demonstrates that you don't have to have an organization to mobilize in the defense of white supremacy, right? Because one of the things about the Klan and many of these organizations is that a condition of membership was you had to be Protestant. Catholics are not allowed to join the Ku Klux Klan. Right? I know this is a kind of a spoiler and shocking, the Catholics can be racist too. So, I didn't say y'all. I didn't say you people. I'm not doing that. But in St. Augustine, there is a large Catholic population. They could not officially join the Ku Klux Klan, but they could form an auxiliary unit. It's kind of a Catholic clan. Seriously. I guess that could be a KKK of sorts, right? A misspelled Catholic. It was an actual hunting lodge. The Ancient City Gun Club. They used the Ancient City Gun Club as the cover to mobilize, organize, and burn crosses and patrol, by the way. So you would see the leader, Hoss Manusi, who said infamously, I don't drink, I don't beat my wife. No, I don't drink, I don't cheat on my wife, I just beat up in words. That was at the first press conference he gave in St. Augustine. Right? Oh, by the way, J.B. Stoner in the bottom left said Hitler was a fine man. Ooh. He is on tape today saying, if there is anyone who is a man among us, you will kill that burr-headed bastard of a dentist before sunup. That's recorded. I've heard the tapes. They're at Emory University. You've got Connie Lynch, who after the church bombing in Birmingham said, good for whoever did it because it's four little N-words who can no longer reproduce. That's being said in St. Augustine, okay? And that's undeniable. It has ramifications, it has repercussions, because Dr. Haling is targeted as the individual behind all of this. He's the person responsible, not racism, not segregation, not indignity. It's him. He's losing customers. As a matter of fact, the sheriff of St. John's County, he said, was one of his customers. He had literally had his hands in his mouth. Oh, yeah, I'm right. Don't discriminate against people that handle your food or do your teeth. Just saying. Dr. Haling also had a bright red VW convertible bug. So his car was noticeable. Everybody knew that was Dr. Haling's ride. So, September 28th, the Ku Klux Klan, 1963, the Ancient City Gun Club decided that they were going to hold a massive cross burning. And just for kicks, they flattened all of Dr. Haling's tires and put flyers on his car. Dr. Haling decided that he would check it out. Everything that I've read about what happened that night contradicts itself. Was he kidnapped? Did he take a wrong turn? Was he there on purpose? When I asked him that question, he just smiled and said, all of the above. The way that it happened is that Dr. Haling and three adult members of the NAACP decided that they wanted to go to see who was there. Who is going to be there that we consider allies who are actually closet Klansmen? The place where the cross burning was to happen attracted over 1,000 people. It was a huge deal. They made a turn on a side street to go behind it. And as they made the turn, two armed men walked out with shotguns. Haling put it in reverse and got stuck. The men, and he also told me he had a Colt 45 pistol in his glove compartment, but he just couldn't get to it. There is a difference between the nonviolent movement that we hear so much about in self-defense, and the line between the two in the South was often very, very murky, right? So, the rally was wrapping up. Connie Lynch was actually on stage. The four men were brought at gunpoint to the front of the stage. And what Dr. Haling said he heard was Lynch say, "Well, well, well, look who we have here." One of the men who was with him, Jimmy Jackson, he said that the thing he'll never forget was the look on the women's faces that were there. They were saying, cut off his privates. And he was a younger man. I think he was 22 at the time. And he thought, I'm never going to have a family. They're going to kill me. And they nearly did. They beat all four into unconsciousness, broke Haling's fingers, piled them together like cordwood. And the last thing Dr. Haling remembered before he lost consciousness being said was, how many of y'all have had the pleasure of smelling an inward burn? This was not that long ago. And that's something that I often remind students. This is not that long ago. 1963 seems like it was forever. It wasn't. Back to the FBI. There was actually an informant in the crowd. And when Robert Haling walked out, his three associates at gunpoint, this man who has been identified as a minister from Daytona, actually went and called the FBI headquarters in Jacksonville and said, they're about to kill all four of them. They called the sheriff and said, stop it right now. It just so happened that some of the deputies were at the rally. So they stopped it. The deputies that were there stopped it literally before they could be executed. Oh, and by the way, four African Americans were arrested and charged with inciting a riot. The adult NAACP had already warned Dr. Haling that you're getting a little too close to the edge. Here's another thing, another theme that I think is really important. Civil rights organizations don't always see eye to eye. They have different strategies, they have different approaches. They don't always agree on what the best strategy is. The adult NAACP is known for being a middle class organization that does not endorse demonstrations. Rather, they pool their resources and challenge segregation in the courts. The legal approach. They basically said, Haling, you're getting a little too close. Things are getting a little too hot in St. Augustine. When he was in the hospital, he learned that the NAACP had fired him and basically took no responsibility for any of the actions that had occurred in St. Augustine. Basically, he's on his own. We don't claim him. Enter the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. The Southern Christian Leadership Conference was the organization of Dr. King. It was founded in 1957 in the aftermath of the Montgomery bus boycott to take the Montgomery model and replicate it throughout the South. And oh, by the way, do you know where the first SCLC boycott of public transportation happened while Montgomery was still going on? Tallahassee. So, C.K. Steele, look him up. With no allies in the NAACP, feeling like his life owed, to talk about daily death threats, in a few weeks, his home is going to be shot into, his dog is going to be killed, he had to send his family out of town for their own safety. It is literally life and death in St. Augustine, and Haling's not sure if he's going to make it out alive. But he knows that he can't stop, otherwise racists' hate wins. So, the SCLC was having their annual convention in 1963 in Orlando. Dr. Haling drove to Orlando to tell the SCLC about the situation in St. Augustine and asked for help. The organization was interested. Because what was going on at the national level was of their utmost focus. This is where the context is important. Oh, by the way, this is the first pamphlet that the SELC put together of St. Augustine, right? 400 years of hate. We are going to have a mass campaign that exposes St. Augustine as a place of bigotry and hate. And you can see at the bottom, sponsored and supported and maintained by Northern Tourist Dollars, right? This is an SELC pamphlet. And that was Dr. Haling hospitalized after almost being killed. So SELC was interested in what was going on in St. Augustine. Now keep in mind, this is 63, December of 63. We're going into 64. What else is going on? Here's the perspective. We are coming out of the most important citywide campaign of the movement, Birmingham, Alabama. It was nicknamed Bombingham. It received international coverage. Bull Connor, police dogs, water hoses, fire hoses, Bibles. Dr. King was not the person in 63 that he is now. As a matter of fact, he was coming off a first major defeat in Albany, Georgia. Okay? In 63, because of the attention that Birmingham got and the federal response, Dr. King asked for a Civil Rights Act. One piece of legislation, you see, Andrew Young later said that Dr. King's real leadership did not start till we went to Birmingham. For a variety of reasons, but the Birmingham campaign is significant on a national basis because it was that campaign where they decided to shift their attention from the local to the national. Why are we fighting battles in places like Montgomery and Tallahassee and Atlanta when we can have the President of the United States with one signature end legalized segregation? That became the focus. John Kennedy went on television the night of the first major night of violence in Birmingham and called the civil rights struggle the great moral crisis of our time, and he promised to deliver personally a Civil Rights Act to Congress. Now, the idea of whether or not Congress is going to pass it is tenuous at best. Why? Southern Democrats. The Democratic Party was the party of the South. Okay? How do you get the Civil Rights Act through with those obstacles? It was going to be tough. One of the things that occurred as a way to keep national attention focused on the importance of the Civil Rights Act was a March on Washington movement for jobs and freedom. It was the largest civil rights demonstration to this date in American history. And the purpose was to demonstrate to the president that you might lose Southern Democrats. You're going to lose some Southern white voters. But guess what? You've got national support. And African Americans who had previously voted Republican, like Martin Luther King's father, said, we will go to our pulpits and our churches and say, vote for the Democrats if this act passes. So all of this that we know about the picture, right? This is one of the most important pictures in American history. We know about the I Have a Dream speech, which, by the way, was not initially supposed to be the I Have a Dream speech, but that's another lecture for another day. We have then the assassination of John F. Kennedy, November 22nd, 1963. Now, a Texan, a Southerner, is in the White House, Lyndon Johnson, who, just months earlier, had been in St. Augustine. This is when St. Augustine becomes part of the national movement, right? The violence in St. Augustine would ebb and flow. The demonstrations continue. SELC sent an organizer to St. Augustine to help the local movement. Okay, so the way that SCLC typically operated was you had Dr. King as the founder and the president. He had two what he called lieutenants. One was Hosea Williams, H-O-S-E-A. And Hosea Williams was a firebrand, man. He was, we've got to get in there and organize and take it to the streets. Defiant, defiant, defiant. His second lieutenant was more conservative. He was more of a politician. He was a negotiator. His name was Andrew Young. What would often happen is that Reverend King, Dr. King, would throw an idea out, a strategy. You know where I'm going with this. Hosea Williams would say one thing, Andy Young would say the other, and he would often come down in the middle. So, in February of 64, King sends Hosea Williams to St. Augustine. Hosea Williams fell in love with the people. Hosea Williams said, through mass meetings and freedom schools, that this is what we're fighting for. People like the ones in St. Augustine. He called it, quote, worse than Birmingham. King was very nervous. Dr. King was nervous that if St. Augustine exploded, that congressmen would use that as a reason to say we're not ready for the Civil Rights Act. That the country is going to blow up. St. Augustine then became of national importance, right? The Easter Campaign was the first major SCLC-directed protest of 1964. And one of the things that happened is that they called ministers from the northern states, particularly they went to the seminaries and they went to the Episcopalian churches in Boston. This, it is so fascinating because the whole time Dr. King is telling Hosea Williams, keep this on the down low. Do what you have to do. Fight the segregation there, but let's not take away from what's going on in Congress. We've got to get the Civil Rights Act passed. So what happens? Oh, the governor's of Massachusetts' mother is arrested in St. Augustine. Mary Peabody, or as their family told me, Peabody. The Peabodys. She is the person that answered the phone in the Boston SCLC office when Hosea Williams called and said, we need help in St. Augustine. Long story short, she basically said, I'm going. And that's the photograph in the bottom right of L.O. Davis, the sheriff, Elmer Fudd looking dude, to the left. Miss Peabody is sitting there with the hat smiling. That's Robert Haling looking totally unamused beside her. And a group, an integrated group, sitting in at the Ponce Motor Lodge. And she basically insisted, I'm going to be arrested. Sheriff Davis was like, you don't want to do this, Miss Peabody. And she's like, oh no, I've got my friends and you read me the law. And he had to go back and get his little legal book and read it. And these photographs are being taken. And it made international news that because she was dining with an integrated party, that Mary Peabody, the mother of the Massachusetts governor, was in a county jail. So much for keeping it on the down low. That is why Dr. King made his first trip to St. Augustine. Okay, so notice something, too. And this is something that I point out to students. Local people start movements. We have not talked about Dr. King up to this point. We've talked about SCLC. And we also, another thing, local people start movements. The interplay between the national and the local is of utmost importance. They feed off of each other and they inspire each other. Communities, people like me and you, can make a difference, is the moral of the story. So, King comes to St. Augustine, he gives a speech at St. Paul AME, and that's where he says a magnificent drama is unfolding in this country. And its roots are in St. Augustine. The Magnificent Drama was the title of the lecture, and it came from how Dr. King labeled the struggle. So, in the meantime, he had talked to Andrew Young and said, get to St. Augustine and stop the movement. It's too vital. They're marching at night. I don't know if y'all have been to St. Augustine, but it's dark now at night. It was worse during this period. There could have been snipers. They literally had to walk by the sheriff's office where police dogs were held. King was afraid that somebody was going to die, and that would have jettisoned the entire Civil Rights Act. Andrew Young, though, the story is, Andrew Young arrived in St. Augustine, entered the church where a mass meeting was being held, walked in the back, and Hosea Williams said, and there's Reverend Andy Young here to lead us in our march tonight. And Andrew Young said, everybody turned around, and I said, I guess I'm leading the march tonight. He did, and he realized just how dire the situation was. The city plaza was ground zero. They would march around it to show that we ain't afraid of your jails, would march back, sing spirituals. On the third night he was there, Andrew Young was attacked and beaten unconscious. It's the first and only time in his life that that had happened. Now, Andrew Young said, quote, St. Augustine is where we have to make our stand. As he said, we were all in God's hands because of the situation that existed. Now, keep in mind, in Congress, it had barely passed the Civil Rights Act, the House of Representatives. It's now involved in the longest remaining today, the longest filibuster in U.S. Senate history was to prevent passage of the Civil Rights Act. Dr. Haling on the right, he quickly becomes a forgotten man because by the time we get to the end of this conversation, Dr. Haling has left St. Augustine. He loses everything except his family. Dr. King's, the home where he was staying, he did not stay, and this is kind of common in all campaigns, he would not stay in the same house in consecutive nights for fear that the families would be targeted and put in harm's way. But the situation in St. Augustine was so bad that the one night he stayed in that home, people fired into it, right? The arrest with the police dog in the back, that picture is interesting because according to Andrew Young, Ambassador Andrew Young, the only thing that Dr. King was afraid of, that he feared, were German shepherds. He hated police dogs. I mean, he'd seen them tear into people, hated them. Somehow, the sheriff knew that. So when he was arrested, they put King in and said, oh, by the way, we've got a guest for you, and put the German shepherd in. That's the degree of just spiteful hatefulness that I won't say just characterized St. Augustine. That's the degree of racial animosity that existed in many places throughout the South during this time, and the nation as a whole, right? So, of course, it's you don't let them see you sweat, but one of the privileges that I've had is being able to talk to Andrew Young about this topic several times, and he said, yeah, that was, he pointed that out and said that was the point where we said, Dr. King said that St. Augustine is different. Like I said later, said worse than Birmingham. The demonstrations expanded to the beaches. And this is always an interesting story for students because, you know, they say in their naivete and youthful ignorance, wow, the beaches were segregated? Yep. How can you segregate a beach? They did. Yeah, exactly. They did. Now the goal became, and here's the pivot. King went from saying St. Augustine is going to compromise the Civil Rights Act to St. Augustine can be used as the reason why the Civil Rights Act has to pass. So we've got to keep the momentum going. swim-ins. And these photographs made international news. The attacks. The only reason that the highway patrol is sent to St. Augustine is because the white mobs turned on police officers. It got so violent that in trying to stop people from assaulting African Americans who were in the water, they turned on the police. Then the governor says, oh, we're sending in the state patrol to maintain order. Right? So it continues to spread all the way through the Monson Motor Lodge incident. June 11 is the arrest. This is when Dr. King is arrested in St. Augustine. It remains the only city in Florida where he was actually arrested. And it was for trying to enter the Monson Motor Lodge. Now, if you've been to St. Augustine, the Monson Motor Lodge was on the site of where the Hilton currently is on the bayfront. The Monson Motor Lodge was targeted by SCLC because it was where the Ancient City Gun Club leader, Hoss Manusi, the sheriff, the chief of police, and the mayor would meet every morning to review what happened the night before and plan for the current day. Jimmy Brock, the owner of the Monson Motor Lodge, was also the president of the Florida State Hotel Owners Association. So it was symbolic, right? We can't stay here. We can't enter and have a cup of coffee. Part of the pattern here, and it is a pattern, is that SCLC wanted to create a crisis, draw public attention, which would spark a backlash and demand a federal response. That is, by this time, the game plan. That's what happened in St. Augustine. So now, as the vote for the civil rights bill, the filibuster's over, the vote is being planned, and Dr. King is behind jail bars in St. Augustine. On June 18, 1964, a photograph was taken, the bottom left, that had a tremendous impact on the vote. Four African Americans entered the swimming pool at the Monson Motor Lodge, and the owner got a bottle of muriatic acid and began pouring it in the pool. It was not deadly. The people in the pool didn't know that. Well, one did, because he was a lifeguard. But that photograph was on the cover of the Washington Post the next day when the Senate voted on the Civil Rights Act. George McGovern told Andy Young that, yes, we were talking about it that morning. So this idea that somehow St. Augustine, an incident in Florida, a protest that embodied what was going on throughout the South, had an impact on national legislation, the most important piece of civil rights legislation this nation has passed, is true. On July 1st, the vote was held, the Civil Rights Act passed. July 2nd, 1964, it signed into law. The Civil Rights Act banned discrimination of any kind in any public facilities in the country. And again, the laundry list is long. It went beyond just race. The Civil Rights Act protects every single American citizen from being discriminated against for any reason whatsoever. Period. It's monumental. Yet, SCLC considers St. Augustine a defeat. The legacy here, and that photograph of Dr. King is given the peace sign when he heard that the vote had gone through. He was actually in St. Augustine when he heard Civil Rights Act has passed. And that's the photograph. He won a Nobel Peace Prize in 1964 as a result of his work in having the Civil Rights Act passed. But it's really interesting because I haven't talked about Dr. Haling. I haven't really talked about the people. There are so many different legacies that come out of St. Augustine, but maybe the most surprising thing is what I said earlier. They considered it, if not a defeat, they did not consider it a victory. Toward the end of his life, Dr. King would often recite, and reflecting on the movement and how far we have come and commentating on how far we have yet to go, he would cite victories in and things that he had accomplished in Montgomery, even Albany, Birmingham, Atlanta, Mississippi, but he never mentioned St. Augustine. And I always wondered why St. Augustine was left out of what we call in academia the master narrative, right? I call it the greatest hits of the civil rights movement, from Montgomery to Memphis, right? He never mentioned it. And I asked Andy Young, why did Dr. King leave St. Augustine out of his recollection of the movement? And he laughed and said, because we wanted to forget it. Why did he want to forget it? Because there was no negotiated settlement between the organization and the city leadership that benefits the people. This was the only campaign where the law was signed and SCLC lost its reason for being there. They felt that they had abandoned the people. In fact, just weeks after the Civil Rights Act passed, Dr. King said, some communities had to bear the cross for all others. And St. Augustine is one of those places. There was a degree of guilt. And because St. Augustine is a southern town, a small town, people who had seen the ugliness of others now had to go back to life as usual. And it was hard. It was almost impossible in some cases. Yeah, they achieved a national milestone, and that's important. But those national victories often have local consequences. So the movement is bigger than one man. Local people are the ones who made a difference. If not for local people protesting injustices in St. Augustine, SCLC never hears about St. Augustine. Local movements have national consequences with the passage of the Civil Rights Act. And more importantly, struggle comes with a cost, sometimes literally. St. Augustine was the only SCLC campaign where they spent more on medical care than legal bills. So yeah, it's important to look at how far we come, but we also have to ask, what really does struggle cost? And we have to be willing, in my opinion, to shoulder that responsibility for the good of the nation as a whole, so that we can fulfill our promises equally to all people. Thank you very much for your time.
Dr. J. Michael Butler speaking on Thursday, February 9th at Happy Hour with the Historian, a presentation of the St. Petersburg Museum of History. Today's lunchtime conversation on Radio St. Pete.